Hi, everyone, and welcome to Moms Fighting Autism. I'm your moderator, Nancy Bernatitis. I'm very pleased this evening to be welcoming Julie Matthews. She will be speaking about special diets for autism and ADHD, what you may be missing. Julie is an internationally respected nutritionist specializing in autism spectrum disorder. She is an expert in applying food and nutrition to aid digestive health and systemic healing. Her guidance is backed by scientific research and 10 years of applied clinical experience. She is the author of the award-winning book, Nourishing Hope for Autism, and the creator of Cooking to Heal, Autism Nutrition and Cooking Class. She presents at the leading autism conferences in the U.S. and abroad. Her website is nourishinghope.com. Welcome, Julie.
Thank you so much, Nancy. I'm so glad to be here.
We're so glad to have you.
Well, should I just get started, or?
Yeah, I will remind people that are tuning in via their internet that you can go to the blue box on your screen and click slides to view the slideshow. You can synchronize the slides with either your phone or the webcast audio, however you're listening, by clicking the button at the bottom of the slideshow. Be sure to mute your computer if you're listening through your phone so you don't get an echo. And we're off.
Great. All right, everyone. So I'm Julie Matthews, and I'm a certified nutrition consultant, and I'm excited to talk to you today about special diets. I've been working with a number of special diets for a long time. So I don't know if you would say my specialty or what I do most is work with all the various diets to help customize and determine the appropriate special diet for the individual. So today we're going to talk about special diets and good nutrition and particularly some of the common pitfalls that people run into on special diets. So I'm really excited to be here and share that with you today. And the little text at the bottom says I'm not a doctor and this isn't a substitute for medical care. So just thought I would say that. And our sponsor today is actually Houston Enzymes. So I'm excited that they are part of what we do here very often at Nourishing Hope. So I'm happy to support them as well. All right. So I mentioned that I'm a certified nutrition consultant, and I've spent the last 10 years studying and researching and working with families, particularly with autism. That's what my book is on, and that's usually what a majority of my research is on. But ADHD and the other developmental delays are very closely related with very similar underlying causes, and we're going to be talking about a variety of diets and nutrition information for children with various developmental delays. I think that's probably the most important part. My book is called Nourishing Hope for Autism, and I have a variety of other learning tools and resources to support families as well. So I want to start out by talking a little bit about autism specifically. This is Mothers Fighting Autism, so most of this will be talking specifically about autism, so I'll give some background of the biochemistry in ASDs and what's going on, which helps us to make certain choices and decisions in terms of dietary and nutrition interventions. And so autism, what I want to say about it is a term that Dr. Martha Herbert coined, which is seeing autism as a whole body disorder, and the brain being downstream from all of the biochemistry that's going on in the system. So this slide is basically the part on the left-hand side is from my book, and it just shows you a lot of the complexity that goes on physiologically with children and adults on the spectrum, and how all of this biochemistry and how all of these body systems, all of this is down, the brain is downstream from all this stuff going on. So the brain is directly affected. And so instead of us seeing autism as this sort of mysterious brain condition for which we don't really have any way to access, we can see that when we look at autism as a whole body disorder, and that what's going on in the body and the health of the body directly affects the brain, which is part of the body, and is downstream from all of that kind of chaos going on, then we can see how this is directly affecting what's happening in the brain. So when you have yeast overgrowth in the gut, this yeast can create toxins that go to the brain. When we have inflammation in the body, we can create systemic inflammation that affects the brain. When we don't have good detoxification, those toxins can affect the brain. When we don't digest our food properly, those nutrient deficiencies will impact the ability of the brain to make the connections and things it needs to do. And when we don't break down our foods properly, we can often create opiate compounds, and those opiates affect the brain that is also downstream. Or the opiates go, they fit in the opiate receptor in the brain, and they affect us just as any other opiate would, and as we know, that can have some pretty significant effects. So the point here is that you can see very directly that the brain is being affected by all this going on. So when we see autism as a whole body disorder, it can really help us see that there are many things that we can do to actually reduce the symptoms of autism, and in some cases, even recover and lose the diagnosis of autism depending on the individual and what's going on for them. So this is kind of another way of showing that, but a little bit different in that I kind of lump these body systems into sort of three systems, which are the immune system, digestion, and detoxification. And each individual might have a bigger bucket or a better functioning system in one area than another. So they sometimes will say, oh, certain kids are gut kids and certain kids are immune kids. But in general, while every child is different in what their picture looks like, all of these systems will have a direct effect on what's going on with the brain and the brain chemistry. So these are the types of systems we look at in terms of finding food choices that can help us change this biochemistry and support the biochemistry in order to see improvements. The GI tract, or the gut, the gastrointestinal system, however you might want to describe it, is probably one of the most important parts of all of this. As Hippocrates, the father of modern medicine, said, all disease begins in the gut. And that is very true. If you look at anybody with any sort of a gut issue, there are going to be other health implications of that. And that's because the gut is what digests and breaks down our food. So we can't get access to the amino acids for neurotransmitter creation or the vitamins and minerals and all those things that we need if the gut isn't functioning. As well, the largest part of the immune system is found in the gut, and even serotonin, which is a feel-good brain chemical, 90% of that is actually found in the gut as well. So we see that even these systems we're talking about, they have some direct connections to the gut. And we know through a lot of different research, whether it's Dr. McFabe or other research and books that have been written, that there is a direct connection with the gut and the brain, and hence the term the gut-brain connection. So the gut is really important. I think the other really important thing here to note is that on one level, yes, we are what we eat, but really, truly, we are what we digest, because even if we eat it, but we can't digest it, we won't be able to have access to what we need to. And so the gut plays a really important role. And the other thing is that every time we eat food, that food comes in contact with the gut and may affect us in either a positive way or a negative way. And so we can't really separate the food that we eat and our dietary choices from the health of the gut, since it's having constant contact with the gut as it's going through. So we'll probably come back over and over again to making certain choices because of the way they support and help heal the digestive system. Now, not everybody has gut issues, and sometimes there are gut issues that aren't really notice. So, I mean, I even know some adults that have been suffering their whole life with a variety of different conditions like gas or things, and they never really kind of made the connection that they had a problem or this was a problem. And so I think that that's piece two, which is that you may not see really outrageous signs of gut problems, and yet supporting the health of the gut is still important. So how can diet help with all of this digestion and biochemistry support? Well, we want to remove anything that's going to inflame the gut. So the leaky gut is basically a term we use for when the gut becomes too permeable and it doesn't, it becomes inflamed and it allows food particles, large food particles and other compounds to get through the gut that aren't supposed to get in there. And they can create a lot of gut inflammation as well as systemic inflammation and food reactions. So we want to remove the foods that cause that inflammation. We want to add foods that are nourishing and healing to the gut and help reduce the inflammation, and foods that are going to supply the good bacteria that the gut needs in order to have the good intestinal environment to be healthy. When we have nutrient deficiencies, we want to increase the quality of the food that we eat and the digestibility. And this is a big area that I don't want to overlook, because most people with autism are picky eaters, and it's very easy to kind of overlook this piece. And I'm here to say that it's really important that we get nutrient-dense foods as much as possible, and we cook and prepare them in ways that increases that digestibility so that we're able to have access to those nutrients. When there's yeast overgrowth, for example, if you have candida, most women are familiar with, if you get antibiotics and you get a yeast infection, that's because when you wipe out all the good bacteria with those antibiotics, it allows the yeast to overgrow that's normally kept in check by this good bacteria. So when the immune system's not working so great, and the more antibiotics we get, the more chance that there is that yeast overgrowth can be happening. So in that case, we want to remove the things that can feed that yeast, like sugar and refined flours, and add probiotic-rich or good bacteria foods that can populate up that good bacteria that helps to create the balance. And we can go on from there. When there's toxicity, we want to be careful of toxins that are in our food supply and that are in our home. And we want to also, when our chemistry, we won't go too much into methylation and sulfation, but there are certain foods that might be a factor. We're going to talk about phenols later, and these phenols are processed by this biochemistry. And so we might need to remove the foods for a period. We might need to improve those processes through proper supplementation. So you can get an idea of how we can support the functioning of the brain, behavior, learning, and all of that by supporting the health and the biochemistry and the digestive system. So what do parents report? Well, it's a wide range of benefit, some very dramatic examples, and then sometimes step-by-step improvements over time. So it often can be very helpful. One of the first things that parents usually report is some benefit in gastrointestinal symptoms. So again, if you think about the food as having that direct contact with the gut, that's often the very first thing that we see improving because it's that direct connection. Probably the second most popular thing that I hear, or most common thing that I hear, is improvements in language. So anything from a client that I had that went from no words to 200 words, this was a 3-year-old, in 3 months on the GFCF diet. Another dad I know had a son that had words but no conversation, and 3 days on the gluten and casein-free diet, his son almost knocked him over from surprise in that the son had his first back-and-forth conversation only 3 days on the diet. So those, again, are some more dramatic examples, but, you know, increased focus and attention, reduction in hyperactivity. A lot of therapists will say, I don't know what you're doing, Mom and Dad, but keep doing it because I'm seeing some really great improvements. So the other thing that's nice is that you don't have to choose one thing or another. All of these things support each other. So the working on the biochemistry in the body and the brain from that perspective helps the other wonderful things you're doing get even more benefit. Eye contact, sleep. Toilet training is another big one that parents will talk about, skin rashes and various things like that. And so, you know, everything from better health and happiness to full recovery from autism. And it can be diet and nutrition can be a portion of the wonderful things they do and typically is one of the pieces of the puzzle. To some of my clients who feel that it was the most important thing or the primary thing. So, but I want to just kind of give you, set a bit of a framework of what some of the potential is. In terms of diet, I see healing diets as having two components. The first is to remove the offending foods. And actually, this is what all special diets are based on. A gluten-free and casein-free diet removes gluten and casein. A Feingold or fail-safe diet removes salicylates. A low-oxalate diet removes oxalates, and you get the point. So pretty much all diets are based on number one. What most diets don't really take into consideration for the most part is number two, which is replenishing the nutrients and adding good, nutritious, healing, and supportive foods to the diet. So when I first started out with this about a decade ago, GFCF diets were really helpful, and parents were realizing how much of a problem gluten and casein were, so they kind of mainly focused on that, and the diet might have, in some cases, been filled with lots of GFCF candies and cookies and other things. And so we can't forget not only the importance of taking some of the junk foods out, but even more importantly, replenishing and adding the good nutrition in. This is a copy, this is a basically a visual table of contents. I know there's a lot of visual people out there, and so it's basically a visual table of contents of my book, Nourishing Hope. So just while we get into this, if my learning tools can be supportive for you, it starts out talking about the biochemical imbalances and really goes into how that affects the neurological symptoms, similar to what we were talking about so far. It goes into other factors, genetics and environment and those sorts of things, and talks about some of the common physical symptoms and implications. And then we go into diet strategies. We go into dozens and dozens of different vitamins, minerals, and supplements, and all sorts of information about them, how to make choices about them, and the autism or healing diet. So I talk about 13 different diets, and we're going to talk about a number of them today, from the gluten-free and casein-free diet, the specific carbohydrate and gaps diet, the low oxalate, and some of the others that I've mentioned. And then I go into a 12-step holistic approach to really break it down super simple for parents so they can get started step by step. So we're going to actually go through actually some of that step-by-step guide as well today. Okay. So here are some of what I would consider the top six pitfalls of what you might be missing in your special diet right now, or your diet in general. The first one being gluten and casein. The second one is sugar and yeast. Then we're going to talk about grains and special diets that are grain-free. We're going to talk about phenols and salicylates, oxalates, and then a lack of good nutrition. So these are the top things that I see that tend to trip up parents and practitioners alike, actually, because sometimes parents, some of you might have had this experience. Either you try a diet like the gluten-free and casein-free diet and you don't get the results you were hoping for, or at the beginning of a diet you see wonderful results and those results seem to diminish over time, or some other combination of things. And so that can be some of these pitfalls at play that are affecting this. So we're going to start with gluten and casein and other food sensitivities. All right. So I am going to start with So this is my 12-step guide, and just for the sake, I do other presentations where I go through them from beginning. We're going to skip all the way to step 5, which is beginning an ASD diet or beginning a healing diet, so that we can talk about the gluten and casein components. All right, so food allergies and sensitivity. So I want to just describe a little bit here the difference for some people that are new. I'm going to try, because what I find very often is that parents in the audience will have a wide range of experience, some who haven't tried diet at all, and some who are very, very knowledgeable and have been doing this for a long time. So I'm going to try to provide some helpful feedback for the full range here. So for people that are maybe new to all of this, a food allergy is something like typically when you think of peanuts, where you break out in hives or you go into anaphylactic shock. It's a very acute, immediate response, and it can be very life-threatening in some cases. Whereas a food sensitivity is a different type of an immune system response. It's what's called an IgE response. There may be also other antibody responses or reactions in there as well that we're learning all the time about. But these create more chronic, delayed response. So you're not going to typically notice it minutes after you eat something. So it's a lot more difficult to determine a food sensitivity. They also tend to be kind of chronic conditions like constipation or inflammation or pain or something like that, where you have this maybe every day and you don't really see it change from moment to moment or from food to food. And so typically, now, children with autism do have an increased likelihood of having food allergies. But what we're usually talking about for a lot of people are food sensitivities. So a lot of people have gone to their allergist, and their allergist says, well, you don't have a food, you're not allergic to milk, so it's fine. We're not really talking as much about food allergies. Yes, get those things diagnosed and address them appropriately, but much of what we're talking about here are the food sensitivities. So some of the common food reactions, gluten, casein, and soy are the top three. Corn is probably number 4. It's certainly in the top 5. There's eggs there up at the top, citrus, all nuts, particularly peanuts, but all tree nuts as well. So these are some of the top ones, shellfish, fish, things like that. Even if you're going to look at meat, sometimes beef, but I think that be nice to see grass-fed beef broken out from regular beef, which I've never seen before. So these are some of the most common ones. So let's talk a little bit about why people might react. Well, we talked about the IgG reaction. IgG creates inflammation, and it creates an immune system response. So it can create a lot of, I think of several categories. I think of pain, so digestive pain, headaches, aches and pains, joint pains, just pain in general, as well as mood and energy type things. So hyperactivity, anxiety, depression, and then just general gut symptoms. So in addition to those IgG reactions, there's also the possibility of particularly an opiate reaction, where actually opiate type substances are created, and those can literally act like morphine or heroin or opium and really create a lot of foggy thinking, spaciness. We'll talk more about that, but some of those types of symptoms. Looking at inflammation, the possibility of lectins, autoimmune responses, all sorts of things. So you can do testing, and I've listed a few tests and things as well that people often will consider, and I think it's always good to get more data. But really the gold standard among most practitioners is to try the diet, because there are so many different ways you could respond and probably ways that we haven't even determined yet. Like a new one is cerebral folate deficiency, and that's a brand new one, and that's only very, very recent. So in other words, the gold standard is to try the diet and see how your individual child responds to it. So what's supposed to happen is digestion is supposed to take these long chains of amino acids. Think of each one of those little colored balls as an amino acid. It's supposed to break down each one of those into all the different little amino acids so that they can be digested, absorbed, and then assembled into various other things like brain chemicals and building blocks and things you need for repair and all of that. When someone's not able to break down gluten and casein specifically, as well as soy, what's interesting is that they have when digestion is weak, instead of breaking them down all individually, it'll break into these long chains. And these long protein chains aren't supposed to absorb, but if you have leaky gut, they absorb into the bloodstream, and then they create a whole host of challenges, including fitting in the opiate receptor and acting like these drugs we're talking about. So one of the things that we need is good digestive enzyme function. And when our digestion in our gut is inflamed, we don't always have those digestive enzymes we need. And in fact, we know with autism, very often those digestive enzymes are diminished. And there's a particular enzyme called DPP4 that helps to break down gluten and casein. And so, interestingly, that's damaged by heavy metals and pesticides, two factors we know are involved in autism. And so one thing that people will often do is to include digestive enzymes into their approach so that they can help break down some of those compounds. So number one, they're able to digest all their food better and absorb their nutrients better, but also to help break down some of the gluten and casein proteins and opiate compounds that can get created. And so, as I mentioned earlier, my sponsor happens to be Houston Enzymes, and I have one of their enzymes here, which is their broad spectrum that includes the DPP4 in it. So there's a lot of wonderful enzymes, and I've been working with Houston a long time, and I really like their enzymes. So I thought I would bring that up for those of you who maybe haven't looked into enzymes yet. So when the gut's not healthy, the opposite thing happens, and I mentioned all that already. You get these long protein chains that are literally morphine or opioid-type chains. And so those can really cause a lot of problems for people. When you think about what opiates can do, if anybody's ever needed morphine before, well, firstly, it's highly addictive. So often these children are very addicted to gluten foods and dairy foods. High pain threshold, spacey behavior, an inability to form words, aggression, stimming, mood changes, poor eye contact, all sorts of things that we see with the children with autism as well. And very often parents will report that some of the kids or the group of kids that are creating opiates, they will see a very dramatic change in many of these symptoms when they are doing the diet. So the diet works, just to kind of wrap that up, in many different ways. That's why trying the diet is the most helpful thing. It helps eliminate those opiate peptides, and we know that there is an increase in those peptides for children with autism. Reduction in inflammatory compounds, IgG antibodies, it's removing things that are causing general inflammation to the gut and causing other, kind of chain of reaction from there. It also removes processed wheat and dairy that can contain propionate, which is interesting because Dr. McFabe did work to find, did studies and found a gut-brain connection with that. And that is an additive that's often added to wheat and dairy-based foods. So by removing those foods, you naturally remove that compound. And then adding nutritious, good, healing foods and supplements is just an important thing to remember as well as you're going through the process. So I'd like to talk a little bit about some of the studies. I won't go through them all right now. Normally, my slide would not have this big unquestionable thing until after we've gone through it. But right now I don't have access to the multiple layers, so it's kind of impeding our view here a bit. But I wanted to put things like for autism, asthma, ADHD, various conditions, we can see how food sensitivities are affected or how food sensitivities affect them. And there are a variety of studies on opiates, on digestive problems for people with autism in association with gluten and casein, and a reduction in autistic symptoms for people that go on a gluten-free and casein-free diet. So what I want to say here is that when people say that there is no science or to the diets and things, that's just absolutely not true. There are you know, many, many, many studies, and that's one of the things that was really important to me in my book and even on my website, is to put hundreds of different scientific references that talk about the biochemistry of kids on the spectrum, as well as what's happening with these foods and the diets and all of that, to really help people see that what they're seeing is real, that the improvements they're seeing are actually based in science that we know that exists already. And new studies come out all the time, and so that's why if you go to my website, I'll often in my blog area put some of the new studies up and talk about some of the new studies that haven't quite made it into my book that come out all the time. So gluten-free and casein-free foods to avoid. Gluten-free. So gluten is... I said that wrong. What I meant to say is gluten-containing foods to avoid, and that is particularly the these are the proteins that are in grains, particularly wheat. So wheat, rye, barley, spelt, kamut, those kind, as well as commercial oats. Commercial oats are oats do not have gluten, but they get cross-contaminated in fields and in factories and various ways. And so oats are always considered cross-contaminated with gluten unless you get specially certified gluten-free oats that are available. And we can, you know, answer questions about that later if people have any. Also, hidden sources. So this is just another thing to be aware of. If you haven't done diet yet, looking at gluten and casein is probably one of the first places that people will often look at. And one of the areas that takes a little bit of practice or a little awareness is that, oh, there's all these hidden sources of gluten. And so just being aware that things like potato chips can be dusted in flour and it doesn't have to be listed on the label and things like that, spices. So once you get involved in this, it becomes very easy over time. But you just want to make sure that when you're doing it, you get some good support to do it so that you are aware of all of those little components. And this actually might be a good time to mention, I wanted to offer a free gift for everybody that's on the call. And so I have a step-by-step guide for what I call it my step-by-step guide for GFCF success. And it's really a lot of things about what things contain gluten, what things contain casein, gluten-free and casein-free food options, meal ideas, all sorts of information, and it's free. So I'm going to ask you if you're available to go to your internet or go to your browser, and if you type in nourishinghope.com/momsfightingautism. You'll find this page, and it will, on the left-hand side is the step-by-step guide, and as you scroll down on the left-hand side, you'll see if you put your email in there, we'll send that guide out to you immediately, and you'll have access to that. So I just feel, you know, moms on the front line doing all this work can use as much support as possible, so I always like to, if I can, give parents something that can help them right away. And then later we'll talk about some of the things that are on the right-hand side and some of the other things I wanted to offer today. So that will give you, you know, a way to get going and start thinking about this. And also, if you've maybe been doing this for a while, but maybe your relatives, maybe a spouse or grandparents aren't on board, maybe they don't quite understand it, it's a nice 5-page guide that can really kind of simplify things down for other people as well. So this might not be new to you, but it might be helpful for somebody else. All right. And then casein-containing foods to avoid. So casein is in all milk, all animal milk, whether it's cow, goat, sheep, whatever it happens to be, and all of its derivatives. So milk, butter, cream, all of that kind of stuff, as well as some other kind of obscure things like artificial butter flavor has butter in it, or has casein. I shouldn't say has butter in it, has casein in it. So sometimes when people are doing dairy-free or lactose-free or whatever, it may not totally be casein-free. So be aware that some of the cheeses that are dairy-free have caseinate or other forms of casein in them. So be aware of some of these other ingredients that might be of concern. Also, I want to just say here that while doing a gluten-free and casein-free trial is a 100% removal of all animal milk, because as I mentioned earlier, there's so many types of reactions somebody can have that we want to remove all the animal milks just to see what improvement is possible. But it is possible that you can handle one milk over another milk. So once you've done this for many months and you really know what works and doesn't work for your child, you know, there are differences between A1 and A2 beta casein, which is found in goat's milk versus cow's milk. Also, there's camel's milk, which researchers say has a, quote, new beta casein molecule that they've never seen before. And most of the kids I've heard of that have a casein intolerance to goat and cow's milk are able to tolerate camel's milk. So camel's milk seems to be a very different animal, pun intended. So just some things to think about, but I don't want to confuse people that are new. I don't want them to think that you can just, you know, switch over to goat milk and try that. Really, a true casein-free trial is removing all animal's milk. Then if once you get well-versed, then you can look at it further. So you can go onto my website, and in my blog area, I have an article on A1 versus A2 beta casein. I also have an entire article on camel's milk, and they're both scientifically referenced with the studies that are out there right now. So those might be interesting and helpful for some of you. Okay, so soy is not a good substitute for casein or for, for dairy, I should say, or for just protein for people that are vegetarians, and that's because soy is broken down by the same enzyme, DPP4, that gluten and casein are. So it also can create those opiate compounds. It's also very inflammatory to the gut, very difficult to digest, and it's very high in oxalates and phytates and lectins that we're going to talk about later, and these inhibit mineral absorption. And so certain compounds in there can block thyroid function and are endocrine disruptors and mimic estrogen. So there's so many reasons that I'm just not a fan of soy, and there are so many better choices for a dairy-free diet. And then corn is another one. It's a really common allergen. Also, for people that have yeast, it's very high in fungus, which feeds the yeast. It has lots of herbicides. It's genetically modified very frequently. So a lot of people do not do well with corn, and so a lot of people will remove it or reduce it. And my suggestion would be to eat only organic if you eat it at all, because hopefully, if you eat organic, it won't be genetically modified, and you'll be at least not having all of that and the herbicides and all the toxins and everything that come that way. So I think that's just an important thing about some of these other food sensitivities in addition to gluten and casein. So here's that free GFCF guide that I had mentioned to you that's available. Please feel free. You can, it's super simple. You'll get it pretty much immediately as soon as you go onto the website. Okay. So let's see here. Terms of sugar and yeast, that's pitfall number 2 that I want to talk about. So, in terms of the step-by-step approach, we're going to kind of do a couple things here. One is looking at some of the diet basics and cleaning up sugar and some of the junk that's in the diet. But the second part of that is actually, in my world, is sort of step 9, which is really working on cleaning up the gut. So, getting a good bacteria balance in there and getting rid of the pathogenic organisms and things like that. So, starting with sugar, sugar is probably one of the primary things that yeast feeds on. So, limiting, significantly limiting, and in many cases, avoiding sugar is really an important concept to that. In addition, it also depresses the immune system and adds to inflammation. It makes it harder for the anti-inflammatory compounds to come into play. So sugar just has so many things going against it for the kids on the spectrum. Regular cane sugar, I mean, they all have their set of problems. Cane sugar uses a lot of chemicals in the refining process and is a common food sensitivity. Agave uses a lot of really strong refining techniques and is really high in fructose. So best to stick with a few of the more natural ones, like raw honey or grade B maple syrup or something like that, or fruit. But remember that all sugar will feed yeast and depress the immune system, even fruit, so just be careful of your sources. And then remember or realize that juice is very concentrated in sugar, and dried fruits as well. So be very aware and limit those as much as you can. And then people often aren't aware that a tablespoon of ketchup has a teaspoon of sugar. So that's a lot, and I like to point it out. All right. So yeast, many of the challenges with yeast are that it's, you know, it's inflammatory to the gut. It can contribute to problems with other pathogens and just create an environment in the gut that makes it allow the bad bugs to thrive, the bad pathogens and things to thrive. It's the yeast, your body's constantly trying to fight off the yeast all the time, and so it can really add an overwhelm or a stress to the immune system. And then it can also perpetuate yeast overgrowth, as we had said, very specifically. So what we want to look at here is, you know, sometimes people will do, like an example I gave earlier, they'll do a special diet, but for example, rice flour cookies are gluten-free, but they fit on a gluten-free diet, but kids that go on a gluten-free diet but they don't see benefit, or they see some benefit but not benefit in other areas, you know, you just want to look at the overall diet and make sure there isn't too much sugar, there aren't too many refined carbohydrates, pretzels, crackers, chips, bread, all that kind of stuff that can feed yeast, because this can not only mask the good results you might be seeing from your special diet, but can also just create a series of health problems that can really cause symptoms and prevent children from healing as they should. So in this case, typically the focus is on a caveman-style diet. So a cave in the old days, what we typically evolved on was a diet that consisted mainly of meat and vegetables and some fruits, a little bit of nuts, maybe whatever could be foraged, fish, maybe even some eggs potentially. The things that are in our more modern diet, like starches and grains and sugars, are the things that were not around back then, and so those are not part of the caveman diet, and hence you'll see why that caveman diet really supports the starving out of that yeast, and so that's kind of one way to support the gut. All right, so pitfall number 3 is talking about grains. So this really leads into step number 8 for me, which is kind of refining the autism diet. So I know we're jumping around a little bit, but you know, if you have or you get my book, you'll see it step by step. And if you even get some of my other courses, you'll see them gone through a little bit more in order. But so grains. They're typically very inflammatory. So I created a food pyramid, and we'll talk a little bit about it today, and you'll notice that the grains are at the very, very top of the pyramid because they're they're the most difficult thing for people to typically handle for a variety of reasons. They're inflammatory. They're high in these compounds that are that bind to our important minerals. The refined forms, and even any grains for some people, can really negatively affect blood sugar. And they can also affect our ability to absorb nutrients if they're creating inflammation. They can create a lot of digestive discomfort. One of the things that you can do to support your consumption of grains is to, instead of using refined flours, use whole grains that you soak. When I say at a minimum soak, you can soak them, you can even ferment them. Some people do a gluten-free fermented sourdough bread or something to that effect, and that can help to break down those even more. Soaking helps with phytates and oxalates, but doesn't help with lectins. Lectins have to be fermented, or the grain has to be fermented in order to reduce the lectins. Many people will consider a grain-free diet, so both the specific carbohydrate and the GAPS diets, but also we talked a little bit about the paleo diet and the primal diets. Those are also diets that remove grains. We didn't really talk about lectins before, so I want to just briefly talk about them. You know, they're found in grains, but also beans and even other things. So dairy is one of them, nightshades. And particularly pasteurized dairy, because there's when you have raw dairy, it has secretory IgA, and that helps to bind the lectins. So I think that's kind of interesting. And I'm not particularly talking about raw dairy here, but I do a lot with raw dairy, and if people have questions about it, I'm happy to answer those too. So lectins, basically, they're not easy to break down. They're inflammatory. They basically cause the blood to clot and can create all sorts of damage to the gut, and then it can allow that whole cycle of leaky gut and all of that. And then in circulation, lectins, that's when they can do some more serious damage as well to the organs and all of the blood clotting and all that kind of stuff. So, when you're doing one of the grain-free diets, then you naturally have somewhat of a reduction in lectins. In fact, interestingly, these diets often, for the most part, eliminate a lot of beans and other things that are also lectins as well. So in a way, these diets, the specific carbohydrate, GAPS, paleo, primal, they're in a way kind of low lectin diets. Not 100%, but I do find it interesting they remove a lot of lectins. Okay, so let's talk a little bit about the specific carbohydrate diet for people that don't know. It removes disaccharides and polysaccharides. So only that one little monosaccharide, that little one sugar molecule, that's what the gut absorbs. If it's in those larger, the disaccharide or the chains, then the gut is not supposed to absorb those, the gut needs it to be a monosaccharide to absorb. And so what happens is this diet only allows the saccharides that don't require further digestion, because what they found was that when you have inflammation, and so this was created by Elaine Gottschall, the term specific carbohydrate diet, and she brought this forward initially. And what we found in today's world is that we know that children with autism have a decrease in carbohydrate digesting enzymes. And we also know that when you don't have enough carbohydrate digesting enzymes, then these sugars and starches go through the digestive tract. They can't get absorbed, and instead they're food for the bad bacteria and the bad bugs. When I say bad bugs, I mean like the bad bacteria, the yeast, all that kind of stuff. So then what happens is that the pathogens get stronger and create more inflammation and then the body creates more mucus to try to buffer it, which means the enzymes are inhibited further from getting through the mucus, and you see that very quickly a vicious cycle is created, hence Elaine's book called Breaking the Vicious Cycle. So that's what this is based on, is only eating carbohydrates that are monosaccharides and avoiding the ones that would create this chain of problems. So from that diet, there is a diet called the GAPS diet, which is called the Gut and Psychology Syndrome Diet by Natasha Campbell McBride. And she's a doctor that used this diet on her son, who has autism, or I don't know his current state in terms of diagnosis, but he had autism. And she got great results from that diet and has refined it further, put some good nutrition principles in there, deviated slightly, so there's different rules to some extent, but basically the food groups and the food lists are the same. So no grains, no corn, no potatoes, no soy, most beans are out, although there's some that are allowed, no sugars, no added sugars except for honey. There's no like starches and thickeners, pectins and things like that, no chocolate or carob. Again, the GAPS diet has some slight deviations from this. But what you can do in terms of carbs, fruits, vegetables, honey, are all have sugars and carbohydrates, and you can do those as long as those vegetables are non-starchy vegetables. But also, you know, all the other kinds of things you'd find on a caveman-style diet. There's meats and eggs and nuts and seeds if they're tolerated. In this case, they do certain beans, lots of different fats. Ghee, I mentioned ghee here, which I should say is ghee is made from butter, but it's clarified, so it should be casein-free. There are some brands out there that are certified casein-free, so you can be sure that there is no casein in those. So this is kind of how the diet is set up. It's the SED diet wasn't initially casein-free, but I've always done it casein-free, and the GAPS diet starts out as casein-free, and I think that is important when you have an individual on the autism spectrum. So just briefly for those people that are curious, so in terms of the SED GAPS versus the Paleo Primal, the difference really there is that, well, that neither of them allow grains, and Paleo doesn't allow any added sugars, but SED GAPS allows honey. Paleo Primal doesn't do any beans, whereas SED allows certain beans. SED doesn't do any starches, and Paleo Primal, it depends who you talk to. Those starchy potatoes and tubers and things are optional. And then the same thing on the dairy, whereas for SED, you can do certain types of dairy that are fully fermented not to have any lactose. But again, that's if you're using dairy in your version. So just a little bit of refinement for some of those people out there doing that. All right. The fourth pitfall is phenols and salicylates, and to me, this is where we're really getting to the big pitfalls. To me, these next two pitfalls are probably the top two that I see, and I think really wonderful things to consider. So let's dive into this one a little bit. So step number six in my book is addressing phenols. And then let's talk about what those are. So phenols or salicylates. So salicylates are a naturally occurring type of phenol. A phenol is just a particular kind of a benzene ring. It's like you can see this little chemistry thing here. That's a phenol ring. And in the body, it matters because these phenols have to be, quote, detoxified by a process called sulfation. And that requires sulfate or a form of sulfur. And very often, children with autism, we know from studies done by Rosemary Waring, they don't have the sulfate, the PST enzyme, and the ability to process these salicylates like the rest of us do. And so they create very often things like red cheeks, red ears, hyperactivity. Those are the three most common, kind of those are sort of the classic symptoms. But you can also get a really wide range of symptoms, everything from sleeping challenges to aggression, diarrhea, even constipation. I had a client the other day, head banging, self-injurious behavior, and a variety of other things too. So these can really create a lot of challenge. And they occur both artificially in things like artificial colors, flavors, and preservatives, but they also occur naturally in the form of salicylates, which are found in plants. And this is where a bit of the pitfall comes in for a lot of people. So most of us, especially if we have picky eaters, feel like, oh my goodness, thank goodness they're at least eating fruit. They're eating apples and grapes and all these natural whole foods, which normally would be great and normally is a wonderful thing. But if you can't process these chemical, these compounds, they can really be a problem for you. And so since we know that people with autism have an increased challenge with these are definitely something to look into. So let me give you a really common pitfall. I know a number of I've heard this exact story on a number of occasions, which is that a family will start out new, and they'll start with the gluten-free and casein-free diet, which I think is a great diet to start with, and they won't really see the benefits they were hoping to see. They don't really see much change at all. And maybe what they did, let me say this. So then what is typically happening in for the cases I'm thinking of is that they took out the gluten and the casein, but if those phenols are still creating hyperactivity and aggression and irritability and all these other challenges, then those other challenges are masking any of the benefits that parents or many of the benefits that people or parents might see from implementing that initial diet. So unfortunately, what I hear sometimes is people say, well, I did the gluten-free and casein-free diet and it didn't help, so I abandoned the diet and we're not doing any special diet. When what I would encourage people to do is to dig further and to say, okay, well, I'm seeing maybe this little bit of improvement, but what might I be missing? And maybe I should look and see the kinds of food my child really loves and the foods they're eating a lot of and see if maybe there's something in here that's masking the problem. So that is very true of diets like the specific carbohydrate diet and the GAPS diets, where you can't do sugar, but you can do fruit, and you can't do starches and things like that, but you can do fruit, so they do lots of fruit. And so now you might have a diet that is free of grains and all those problematic things, but it might have twice as much fruit as it had before, and fruit is one of the things that's very high in phenols and salicylates. So we're going to talk about a list of what some of those foods are. If your child craves those foods, that's generally an indication that you want to look and dig further to see if there might be some underlying issue there. So just briefly, this is a chart from my book that I spend, I don't know, probably 40 pages. I mean, I spend a long time talking about the biochemistry, and I go a lot through this chart. But really the important parts for us today, the first part in blue is methylation. You may have heard of that before. Then there's transsulfuration, and this little orange box is sulfation. So you need all that stuff working to make sure you've got enough sulfate to be able to detoxify the phenols. So if any of those processes before that aren't working very well, or you don't have the B12, B6, folic acid, magnesium, zinc, and things that you need to push the pathway along, or you have some genetic variant like MTHFR or something like that, you might not be able to do all of that. Very often, these kids can't do that. And what you end up with is an inability to handle these foods that are supposed to be very nutritious for us. So this is what we often see in autism, which is a decrease in glutathione and a decrease in sulfate, so a really difficult time processing these food compounds. So one of the main forms of phenols are the artificial ingredients. So anything made from a petroleum base, are the artificial colors, flavors, and preservatives. They are really strong phenolic compounds, so be very careful of those. Now, the rest of these aren't necessarily phenols. They're just other things that I think are really important to remove from the diet. MSG, monosodium glutamate, creates a lot of issues, and actually glutamate, the high glutamate foods have a similar process and pathway to some of these things. So I'm just going to For the food additives, I'm going to kind of leave it like that for now. I have lots of other presentations that go more into these additives and things to remove, but I want to highlight those artificial colors, flavors, and preservatives, which really are big problems for people that have an issue with phenols. I want to go into what some of those foods are for those of you who are kind of curious or suspicious at this point. The big ones: apples, grapes, and berries are the top, to me, those are the top three. So I had one client that would eat the skin off of 7 apples in a day. Oh, by the way, most of the phenols are found right in and under the skin. So it's not really typical for kids to eat the skin. So when there was a child eating the skin on 7 apples, that was a sign for me. I have another client who the grocer knows them because they are the only two people, even though they never come in together, they're the only two people that ever buy an enormous bag of apples every couple days. So that was another indicator there. So apples, berries, all the different berries, really, as well as grapes, and particularly red grapes, but any of them, and lots of fruits. So this is where it can be a little bit discouraging because, of course, you want to feed your kid all these super wonderful, healthy foods, and they are healthy, but they're not healthy for you if your biochemistry can't support them. Spices. So Indian spices are wonderfully healing and anti-inflammatory, like turmeric and cumin, but very high in salicylates. So when I see a child like I saw the other day where there were just, you know, usually you don't have kids that love super spicy foods, but this child loved mustard and loved spicy foods and loved all these things. To me, that was a clue that I should dig a little bit further and see what's going on. So cravings for the foods is something really to look at and to consider. So this is the Feingold list of foods. The Feingold diet removes this list of salicylates. There's another diet that's much more strict called the fail-safe diet, and it removes salicylates, but also it removes amines and glutamates. So these are some of the additional salicylates that this diet removes, including avocados and you know, spinach and water, you know, the melons and things like that, as well as all the amine-rich foods, which I won't go into all these now, but these are even things like fermented foods and bone broths, which are wonderfully nourishing foods and really a great part of, like, the body ecology diet and the GAPS diet. And we all think that these are just superfoods, which, again, in some ways they are. So it's easy to kind of become blinded that it can't be that food because that food's so good for you, but those foods are high in amines and glutamates. And so, again, this is why what I want to do here is not to overwhelm you, but to help you become your own food detective to try to figure out what it might be for your child that they're negatively reacting to, and then strategically remove, ideally, just the foods that they're having a problem with. Because it's very easy when you listen to this talk or many of my talks to think, oh, salicylates are bad, oxalates are bad, these are bad, and then you end up with a list of 3 foods, and then you have a different set of challenges. You don't want to overly restrict a diet because you want enough diet to continue to rotate foods so you don't create food sensitivities from the foods you eat every day. So that's why really the goal is to take out the foods that are a problem, but not to overly restrict a diet. And amines, bananas are big amines, so low salicylate, but so people will often keep them in, but they're really high in amines, and they're often a problem as well as some of those other things I just mentioned. And glutamates, we talked somewhat about glutamates, not only MSG, but the naturally occurring high glutamate foods as well. So fail-safe is a diet that addresses all of those various food components. Okay, I want to talk about oxalates, and so the pitfall is not actually the low oxalate diet. The pitfall is oxalates. This is probably one of my very favorite dietary interventions, and if you go on my blog, or if you ever join me on Facebook, I post these things there too. But for now, if you go to my blog, there was a post that I did maybe last week, and it's an interview with Carla from the Low Oxalate Yahoo group. And it is over 2 hours. It's a 26-page transcript, and it's free. And you can go on there and you can get access to the recordings and the information for that. So I want to talk somewhat about oxalates because I find it such a really fascinating and exciting new area that we are learning so much about. So this step really involves in looking at refining your autism diet and helping to clean up the gut. Okay, so oxalates are these crystals. crystal, these inflammatory crystals that we most often associate with kidney stones. Now, we know from a recent study that came out done on children with autism that you do not have to have kidney stones in order to have an issue with oxalates. And they found that these children had an increased level of oxalate that was consistent with people who have a genetic condition where these oxalates are really causing them some serious metabolic and health challenges. So people were a little surprised to find out oxalate played such an important role, and I think we're going to find out even more in the future about how problematic oxalates are for a lot of people and a lot of conditions. Pain-related autoimmune conditions, I think, are something that people should look at. We know vulvodynia and some of those pain-related conditions like that. So let me say a little bit about oxalates. Oxalates are... as I mentioned, there are these sharp crystals that are very irritating. The other thing about oxalates is they bind to our minerals. And so actually, I won't go into too much detail, but they did a really fascinating study on animals where they fed the, I think it was rats or mice, they fed them a diet with moderate levels of calcium. Then they had another diet, same diet, where they added a whole bunch of spinach. Diet in spinach is really high in calcium. So what they found, though, is that all the rats with the spinach died, and when they did an autopsy, or whatever you do on a mouse, they found that they all were significantly calcium deficient compared to the ones that had a much lower calcium in their diet. And that was because the calcium was in the spinach was bound up and not able to be used, and the extra oxalate was binding to the other calcium and minerals in their diet, creating even a worse deficiency of calcium than otherwise. So, again, it's like, you know, you look at foods and you think, you know, in some ways these foods are really nutritious foods, but we have to really look at the bigger picture here, and particularly if you have an issue with oxalates, you want to be very careful. But I don't know, that study really convinced me that super high oxalate foods will deplete minerals in anybody. And so oxalates are something I'm very careful of. And when we talk about my food pyramid, you'll notice that it's not very high in oxalates. So oxalates can perpetuate yeast overgrowth. Parents will often talk about they'll even do special diets like a grain-free diet and a low-sugar diet, and the yeast hasn't gone away. In those cases, sometimes it could be an oxalate issue, creating irritation to the intestinal tract that doesn't allow for the healing and the kind of kicking out of that yeast. We also know that children with autism kind of have a bit of the perfect storm that allow oxalates to be even more problematic. So if they're not creating oxalates internally, the consumption of oxalates combined with a leaky gut and not very many good probiotics that would normally break it down, and a lot of antibiotics which would kill the good bacteria that breaks them down off, you now can end up with an issue with oxalates that you might not have had otherwise. The other piece to this that I think is interesting is that people that do an SCD diet or even a body ecology diet, these can be high in oxalate foods. So the specific carbohydrate and GAPS diet, they tend to focus a lot on nut flours. And so particularly almonds, like a quarter cup of almond flour has about 10 times the amount of oxalate in an entire day that the low oxalate diet allows. So it's very easy to, you know, when you're on some of these special diets, they have some wonderful principles, but everything kind of needs to be a little bit in balance, particularly if you have the biochemistry that might require that even more. So parents will often say things like improvements in energy, sleep, motor skills. I'm really curious about oxalates in consideration with mitochondrial issues because, long story short, when you have an issue with salicylates as well, if you don't have enough sulfate, the body will shuttle oxalate into the cell, and basically I think of it like a cog in the wheel. It kind of just gums up those works, the cellular works, and the energy, so creating a lot of fatigue, maybe blood sugar problems, thyroid problems, things like that. So So I think oxalates are one of the big areas that become a pitfall that people aren't aware of when they're doing a special diet, because certainly all of these diets are wonderful and have amazing properties and healing benefits. But again, depending on who you are and depending on what the balance in your diet is, you may not be able to tolerate some of these. So originally, the specific carbohydrate diet had much lower levels of these nut flours kind of used as special occasions. But when we have kids with autism, sometimes we'll do, you know, I've had clients eating 9 nut muffins a day because they were replacing their, you know, their gluten cookie and their gluten muffin and their gluten this or that, right? So just keep all of that in mind as you are thinking of these things. Some high oxalates, nuts, beans, beets, greens, spinach has like 700 milligrams of oxalate. If you're trying to get 50 or less on a low oxalate diet. Now, not everybody needs low oxalate, but just to give you an idea, if the range is about 50 and you think that almond flour has 450 and spinach has 700 and 1 tablespoon of chia seeds has 1,000, you can go really overboard on some of these, quote, health foods really fast. So I think it's important for people to just know about these. There are, now, it doesn't mean that all the healthy things are out. You know, some people say, oh, that means that all greens are out and all greens are bad. No, there are lower greens. There's ways that you can cook them to reduce the oxalate by boiling them. So there are a lot of options. Collard greens, some of the kale, those things are much lower than spinach and Swiss chard. So, again, there's always a way to make the diets work, to combine multiple diets together. That's often what I do with my private clients a lot is, number one, choose the best diet, and if that diet is more than one diet, do we combine the diets together? Do we prioritize one of the diets over the other? You know, how do we bring them together without making the diet too restrictive? All right, my sixth and final pitfall, I guess I should say that my pitfall is nutrient deficiency, and the solution is boosting nutrition. And we're going to talk about some of those boosters right now that I think are wonderful things that you can incorporate into any diet, any special diet. So this is where we go into step 7 on my list here, which is boosting nutrient boosters, adding nutrient boosters. So long story short, I'll just kind of keep it short so I have a lot of time to answer some questions, but what we know is that genes are turned on and turned off. They can be turned on and off. How do I explain this? There's a gene sequence, but there's also the ability to change our genetics based on our environmental factors. And the good environmental factors, like good solid nutrition, will turn the good healthy genes in the right direction. When we have nutrient deficiencies and toxins and things, that will turn the genes in the disease-promoting direction. And there were studies done on this during pregnancy as well as during the life of the particular animal or person, and found that this is that nutrition is a really, really important part of an overall healthy disposition or healthy constitution. So that's one piece, but we also know that we need that good nutrition. We need that nourishment for the brain. We need the nourishment to build our neurotransmitters for good feel-good chemicals and, you know, connectivity, to myelinate the nerves for good signaling. I mean, there's dozens and dozens of things that we need this good nutrition for, and we know that most American children do not meet the RDA for most things. In fact, most of them are quite deficient, and if, you know, those are the average kids. So any children with maybe some challenges are often further deficient. So getting good nutrition is really important. So one of the big nutrition boosters is good quality fats. Fats are really important, and particularly grass-fed sources of meats and animal foods like eggs, and if you were going to do dairy, those kinds of things, because there are much higher levels of good fats, good fat-soluble vitamins, as well as cholesterol that we really actually need. So just briefly, many people, you know, we might know that, yeah, we want to get the good, like, olive oil we hear about, avocados and things like that, but we often hear the saturated fat and the animal fats villainized, and so I want to just show you some of the really important things about saturated fat. It's really important for brain development. It's important for the whole system, really. We need it for the bones, for the brain, for the liver, for the lungs, all sorts of things, and there are plant-based and animal-based sources, and all, you know, each of them have their different benefits. So coconut oil is a great one. It's a plant-based one. It's high in antifungal properties and all sorts of good other things that help to help us to use them for energy. The other thing, though, about animal foods is that they contain cholesterol. They also contain what I think is a very important cholesterol is, let me step back. So I was going to say something before I talk about cholesterol, and that is the good fat-soluble vitamins like vitamin A and vitamin D, which are really important for absorption of minerals, but also immune function. So there's a lot of things, and those are particularly in grass-fed animal foods. So we want to get that. But let's talk a bit about cholesterol. And I know I'm kind of I'm kind of jumping around a little bit because there are just a bunch of things that I wanted to kind of get to today. But cholesterol is something also really important. All of the sex hormones and stress hormones are made from a cholesterol molecule. It's important for brain development, digestion, hormones. We know that there are some studies showing that children with autism often, or people with autism, often have cholesterol challenges. So, you know, there is a really appropriate place for a well-balanced diet that has some good quality grass-fed animal foods in it. The other thing is really encouraging the eating of vegetables, and this is probably one of the primary things that I do in my cooking course, which is called Cooking to Heal. Cooking to Heal has like all sorts of ways of making vegetables crispy and crunchy and kid-friendly, ways to make fermented foods and other fermented, you know, sauerkraut and things like that kid-friendly. Obviously, fruits and vegetables are rich in so many phytonutrients, and in my food pyramid, I really talk about getting all sorts of good colorful vegetables. So always try to get some, you know, whether it's beets or greens or, you know, carrots. All these different colors are going to have different nutrients and different benefits. So you get a variety of them in the diet, and that's going to be really helpful. But also I understand the importance of making them kid-friendly. So also juicing, I want to just say that this is often a great way for kids because kids often don't like the texture of vegetables and they often like juice. So it's a great way to get some good concentrated forms of nutrients fresh pressed. I'm not talking about stored and bottled juices. I'm talking about fresh pressed juicing to make sure you've got the nutrients or to make sure that the nutrients stay intact and they're not lost in pasteurization and it's super fresh and available. Another nutrition booster is good fermented foods. So these are going to be, you know, you think of yogurt. That's the one we're most familiar with. That's got good bacteria in it. But many people aren't going to do dairy. So sauerkraut and cultured vegetables, kombucha or young coconut kefir like on the Body Ecology diet, these have really good probiotics, those good bacteria. That's really important for the body. The probiotics help to break down environmental toxins. They help to keep the bowel moving for proper absorption of things. They do dozens and dozens of things. In fact, we would not be alive without good bacteria. And in our society, we pasteurize and kill everything. We antibacterialize everything, and we don't get these probiotics like we used to for generations before. Bone broths are a great way to get some gelatin, some things that are good for digestion, things that build connective tissue. They're also in a nice, easily assimilatable form. It's in a form, it's called an ionic form, and that's a readily absorbable form of those minerals and nutrients. So this is a really great way to boost your nutrient density, but these really must be homemade. store-bought, even if they say they don't contain MSG, are not going to have the same quality of nutrition that you would make yourself. All right, so I mentioned my book already, so I just want to tell you a little bit before I go to Q&A. I'm 2 minutes here on just, you already saw my book, Nourishing Hope for Autism. And so that's a resource that many of you have, but some of you might be interested in. It's got all sorts of food lists at the back to go into much more detail on the phenols and the oxalates and things like that, as well as common symptoms and other resources for implementing the diets and things like that. And then I want to talk about Cooking to Heal. This is my cooking course I used to do live in person in San Francisco, but obviously most of you don't live in San Francisco, so it was hard for most of you to make it. I did have people fly in from New York and various places, but, you know, for most people that's not really realistic. So people asked me to videotape it, so I videotaped it, and it's all online. So the nice thing now is that the cookbook is all in color with color photos. Every recipe is tagged with all of the different diets. So I tag it for basically all the diets I've mentioned today, plus nut-free and egg-free when they are. And I put all the substitutes and how to do that. I spend a lot of time working on egg-free because that one's really a tough one to come up with alternatives and things. So when there were alternatives for and substitutions for nut-free and egg-free, I put those in there. And then there are some there's a number of the videos and demonstrations from the cooking class as well, but there's also a ton of other recipes in addition to the ones that are on the video. And the fermented foods section, I go into great detail because if you haven't heard in my voice, my real passion, I love the fermented foods. I love making them, and I think they're so good for you. So I spend a lot of time helping walk parents through that process. This is how to contact me. My website is nourishinghope.com. And if you're interested in any sort of a private consultation or you even want to get on the phone with me just to see if you think that we would be a good fit for a consultation, maybe you have a very unique situation, you can always call our office, and my husband Martin, as Nancy mentioned, can set us up with some time for that. And also talk to you about various services. Now, I keep mentioning my food pyramid, but I just realized that I didn't actually include a picture of it in here. So if you go back to the special offer that I have for you, it's nourishinghope.com/momsfightingautism. If you go there, I want to just point out a few quick things before we go to our Q&A. So on the right-hand column is an additional offer that I wanted to offer you through this Saturday. So I always feel like, you know, you're on this call, you're taking your time, you're excited, you're passionate about it. I want to give you some incentive to keep going. And so I wanted to offer you actually 4 free webinars of mine that I've recorded when you purchase any of my products. So whether it's, if you look down below and you scroll all the way to the bottom, you'll see my book, you'll see my cookbook, but you can also see a picture of my food pyramid. And my food pyramid includes a 2-hour presentation that goes into great detail about all of the nourishing foods. There's also a 4-hour lecture in there that you can see here called Food and Nutrition for Autism. It's my kind of my virtual course. And there's a whole bunch of other webinars and things. So if you purchase any of my products through this Saturday, I want to give you free these 4 learning modules. And there's 2 on meal planning, and the meal planning involves all the different diets, not just one particular diet. So healthy diets and meal planning, as well as meal ideas for the whole family. And then picky eaters, because that's my other really passionate area. I learned very early on that if a child wasn't going to eat the food, then it didn't matter how wonderful the diet plan looked. So I've spent a lot of time really working on getting good ideas from a nutritionist perspective on picky eating. But I also have a feeding therapist there who's kind of giving me her perspective from that side too. So it's nice and well-rounded. And I think the gem of this whole thing is if you have a picky eater, my husband, we did a Confessions of the Adult Picky Eater. And I've learned that so many of my clients also have a picky eater parent. And so, I don't know, I just, a lot of what I learned from picky eating actually was from my husband, because when we met, Dawn, our feeding therapist, will tell you on the call that he really was considered a problem feeder. So he was a serious picky eater, and it doesn't necessarily go away. So when I met him at 35, he ate about 20 foods. So this is a really good time to really work on being creative and little by little by little by little expand their food choices. And so I'm looking at it from a nutritionist perspective. So those four, they're worth $40 normally, and you can actually go onto the website and buy them, but they are free when you buy any of my products. So consider that, and I am excited to answer your questions.
Julie, let me ask you, is there a special code they need to enter at checkout, or is it just automatic?
They do not. I am going to take everybody that purchases anything through Saturday, and I am going to give you all access to that. So there might
okay.
be a so you're going to get it, and I'll have that. So that's not going to be a problem.
Okay, and there's one other thing. I went on and I tried to get that free download. That's on the left-hand side of the page.
Oh, yeah.
I had trouble with the submit button, and I saw that one of our listeners had trouble, too. Is there another way to access that?
Oh, brother. Yes. Let me go on there right now, and I will give you another link to that as well. Can you get instant feedback from people? Did anybody have success with the button, or is it having a problem right now?
Let me see what the... I've had a couple of people say they're having trouble with the submit button.
Okay.
And I did too.
Okay. And there was nobody particularly that said, oh, yeah, it went through fine?
No, nobody particularly has said that yet.
Okay. All right. So, yes. If you go to also, if you go to nourishinghope.com/GFCFsuccess, you'll be able to find it on that little hidden link as well.
Okay. I don't know how I found it, but I did. So GFCF success.
That's
okay.
It. Yep.
All right. All right.
All right.
Well, let me let our listeners that are using their telephones know that if you'd like to ask a question live this evening, just press *2, and that lets me know that you're raising your hand, and then I will connect you. So *2 if you want to ask a question. And I'll go to the questions that are coming in through the website. Oh, we did have somebody say they had no issues with the download. So,
okay. All right. Great.
Someone else said that they had success at GFCF success. So.
Okay. All right. Very good. So one of those two places you'll get your free gift.
Either
one way or another. Yep.
Okay. What is the first thing that someone needs to do if they're considering a diet to figure out which diet might be best? Do you do blood work, or what are the steps?
Yeah,
that...
to figure out which diet would be best. So I guess there's two potential answers to this question, which is what do I do, or what can you do? So, usually, I mean, there are certain tests that you can do to figure out certain parts of this, but really, in the end, it's usually, for me, a combination of things. So I look at what the diet consists of, if it's really heavy in certain foods, if there's really cravings for certain foods, if they were tolerating something like a particular diet before and they're not tolerating now, I might use those things as clues. I look at the symptoms they're experiencing, because often the symptoms are very, like the oxalate symptoms are often pretty different from the salicylate sensitivity symptoms. A lot of the symptoms are in my book as well, so if any of you have or get that, there'll be a lot of those that you can, you know, kind of help to pull this together that way. There are some tests, like there is an oxalate test that you can do through Great Plains Laboratory. They have an oxalate test, although, you know, oxalates can be a little, like, they go up and down, so that means that, you know, when you're dumping, you're going to have more oxalate, so depending on when you do that test, they may or may not show up. So again, these are helpful things to try, but they don't show the full picture. So that's why I typically use a combination of things. Sometimes I'll look at food sensitivity panels or organic acid tests if someone's wondering about yeast or something. So it kind of depends a little bit on the diet. The phenol thing, there are some clues, but there's not really a great test for phenols. And even when there is a straightforward test, like I said, it's not always, you know, you kind of have to sometimes catch it at the right time or whatever it is. So that's why I like to use a combination of tests when they're available, symptoms, cravings, and experience that they've had with diets and foods in the past.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And how long do you suggest someone try a diet before evaluating whether they think it's successful or not?
Good question. If it's the GFCF diet, that's fairly straightforward. Typically, 6 months is a good time window. Now, my caveats to that are, you know, if you don't see any results after 2 or 3 weeks, start reassessing, you know, let's say a month. If you don't see any results after a month, instead of just blindly following on for 6 months, I would just look at, you know, what other factors might also be at play, or bring somebody in or talk to a mom that's done the diet before to make sure there's no infractions in it. So it might take up to 6 months to really see some good results, but hopefully you'll see something positive that tells you that you're on the right track, and you know, you can refine it as you go as well. But I wouldn't abandon the diet till you give it, 6 months to really know how it's going. With oxalates, so that's how long to kind of give it. Now, you might need longer on the diet, right? So you might need some time to before you abandon the diet or move on to another diet. I mean, you can always move on to a diet sooner than that, but it can take, you know, 3 to 6 to 9 months to get some of those, you know, food protein, opiate-type things out of the system. So that's usually that's a decent rule of thumb and a kind of a good thing to wrap your head around. Like, you know, you're going to want to do it for a few months. Now, at the same time, I will sometimes do food trials that are shorter than that. So, you know, if you need to wrap your head around 1 month at a time, or you want to, like, there are certain diets like the Feingold and the Failsafe diet. Their initial diet is more of an elimination diet and then a provocation testing back phase. So I guess what I want to say there is every diet's a little bit different in how it's implemented and how it's tested back and how long you do something for. But I would just say, you know, 3 to 6 months is your typical time frame.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And how diligent do you need to be when you're implementing one of these diets?
So with the gluten-free and casein-free diet, you really, really need to be 100%. Now, with life, there is no 100% when you have a child with autism that might dive under the table at school and eat a cracker off the floor, which happens to my clients. And so we want, you know, 100% intention to be 100%. And then that's where the digestive enzymes and things come in handy, because, you know, the truth of real life is that sometimes accidents happen. But what we want to avoid is the kind of, we want to avoid the sort of, well, it's, you know, one cookie every few weeks isn't going to hurt, because that kind of thing can really eliminate the benefit you are seeing and really interfere with your trial. So you want to be really 100% with a diet like that. Now, there's other diets that there just is really no such thing as 100%. Like the low oxalate diet just reduces them, and the salicylate diet just reduces them. But, you know, you really want to, in your mind, have a commitment. And the ones like the SCD diet or the GFCF diet, you want to be 100%.
Mm-hmm. I made the mistake when I went GFCF with my son in 2007. I did what you said a lot of people do, is you substitute the gluten-free anything, cookies, candies, anything, just to be gluten-free, but it may not be as nutritionally sound as you'd like it to be.
Exactly. And, you know, like even Skittles are gluten-free and casein-free, but then, you know, so, you know, maybe Halloween or something, you might throw those in, and then, boom, behavior's off the charts because, you know, the artificial ingredients are just too much to handle. So, and I appreciate your feedback on that.
Yeah, that's one of those things that you see a lot of behaviorists using is M&Ms or Skittles as an instant.
Yeah,
you know,
as a reinforcer or something.
Yeah,
I
an
know.
Edible that's gone quickly, but.
Exactly. I know. And just for everybody out there, you know, if I take my nutritionist hat off for a second, you know, you can find any candy or treat food free of all that artificial stuff. It's just used because it's cheap for them to use. You might need to pay more, but you can pretty much find any kind of specialty treat that's free of the artificial junk.
Very good. I wanted to ask, if you find your child is calmed by a certain food, say bread or milk or smoothie or something like that, should you automatically think maybe it's acting as an opiate?
I would, especially something that you know has opiate properties to it. So milk, I mean, I've had clients that say, you know, I mean, you can just see it on their face while they're eating something, you know, that it's just, you know, doing something. It's, you know, they have different ways of describing it. But absolutely, you know, if you have lots of ups and downs and or kids that wake up in the middle of the night and can't get back to sleep without having some cheese, some milk, something like that, those are pretty good indicators that you want to dig further. Or kids that have addictions or sort of, obsession is the wrong word, but like really strong insistence that they need to eat something over and over again, that to me is a red flag that you should dig deeper and see if there's something in there that they're not tolerating. And that's why I like people suggest they get a copy of my book, because in the back are all the different charts. So you can say, well, I know that my child does that with grapes. Let me look at all the other salicylate foods and see, you know, if there's others that they like. Or, oh, grapes are also high in, or whatever, right? So you can kind of try to piece that together.
Mm-hmm. Okay, we have Kareem, and Kareem has a question for you live here, so I'm going to unmute. Hello?
Yes, hi.
I have a question.
Question. Is there a particular milk substitute that you would recommend that's like the most beneficial? Like, I know there's almond milk and there's rice milk and there's even coconut milk. Is there one that's actually better than the other, you know?
Well, a lot of that depends on the special diet that you're doing. So there's a few things I can say. I tend to be not as much of a fan of the starchy milks, so like rice milk or potato milk, because, you know, it's got a decent amount of sugar and it's pretty much all starch and water. So those are typically less of my favorites. But again, it depends on what you're allergic to. So, you know, if you're allergic to nuts, you're not going to do almond milk. And if you have an oxalate issue, you're not going to do almond milk probably. So, you know, another one that I tend to like is coconut milk, because coconut milk is, you know, low oxalate and, you know, typically fine for most people that can't handle nuts. So, I don't know. I tend to like coconut milk in general, but really the answer to that will probably depend a little bit on the person and the diet and their food intolerances.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
Sure. Thank you.
Okay. We had Christine from Los Angeles wants to know if you do nutrition consultations for autism and seizures.
I do. I mean, you know, 30% or more of children with autism have seizures, so definitely some of my clients have seizures. So what I would say is call over to my office, and we can set up 15 minutes and have a little free consultation and kind of get a better sense of what you've done and what you're looking to do. I do have some experience with that, but, you know, it is a medical issue, so I want to make sure you're, you know, being supported in the other ways that you need them to as well. So, but I definitely have clients and have had clients with both of those conditions.
Okay. Chakri, I hope I'm pronouncing that right, Chakri from Edison, has asked a question about the relationship between sauerkraut and asthma attacks.
Hmm. I would love to know more of your question. Are you seeing a relationship with sauerkraut and asthma attacks, or a reduction, or what
Here's
is it?
Here's the question. Here's the question in full. When we increase the amount of sauerkraut, my son gets bad asthma attacks, and we have to give a nebulizer. Why?
Well, I can't say why, but my first suspicion would be the amines and glutamates. The reason I say that is because fermented foods, if you test it out and you say, okay, well, the sauerkraut is made of just cabbage, if that's the case, and you know that they're fine with just cabbage, then I say, okay, it's not the cabbage issue, which leads me to, okay, well, have you tried probiotics? And if probiotics aren't an issue, then it's not the probiotics, like the probiotic supplement, then it's probably not the probiotics in it. And that would lead me to the suspicion of these other things. And the reason for that is that we know that asthma attacks can be triggered by artificial additives, artificial ingredients, MSG compounds, things like that. And so fermented foods have both natural amines and natural glutamates. So that would be my strongest suspicion for you to search further.
Okay.
You know, one of the things that, you know, just to give people a sense, it's like, I can't really answer your individualized questions without really getting into a full consultation. But I'll do my best to point you in some directions for some ideas.
Yes. Kekwan from Malaysia asks, is vegetarianism good for autistic kids?
It's a really good question. I'm not a fan of a vegetarian diet in general. I talk about this a lot in my food pyramid. You know, basically my food pyramid creates a hierarchy of foods. And what I've really found is that kids that need to repair and build need good protein. And the foods that are typically that have the complete, like animal foods have a complete set of amino acids. They are typically one of the least reactionary foods. So when you look at all the special diets out there, meat and those kinds of things usually do the best for most people. When you look at the plant-based proteins, the soy, there's a problem with that. We talked about with nuts and seeds and beans, there's a lot of lectins and phytates and irritating things. So I tend to, for the most part, not be a huge fan of vegetarian diets for children on the spectrum, although I do have clients for religious reasons and others that do a vegetarian diet, and I'm certainly happy to help them make that as nutritious and digestible as possible. But just as a general concept, I think that they're better with some animal protein.
Okay. Do you find that supplements are important when you're trying any diet or any maybe good for any autistic child? I don't know.
Supplements, I think, typically are something to consider for everyone. So, you know, when you're on a dairy-free diet, if your diet is not that well-rounded, you'll most likely need some more calcium. Depending on where you live, like where I live, it's not very sunny, and so we need more vitamin D here. People that have a, MTHFR gene situation, they might need a particular supplement of folic acid. So I definitely think that everybody should consider supplementation. I think digestive enzymes are often great for most people. Probiotics are often great for most people. So I do think that there are some really good supplements. And for the most part, most of my clients are taking supplements of some form, although I don't necessarily think, you know, 40 different supplements and massive amounts of supplements is the answer. And I think that the best way to get the nutrients is through food first. But there is a really appropriate and important place for some targeted supplementation.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Debbie from Illinois asks, my son with autism is 26 years old. We have never tried any of the diets. Is it too late to try something?
No, definitely. This I feel really very strongly about. I met someone once that changed their, they had a an adult child with autism, I think in their 50s, and I had heard they got some good benefits. I also know I have a client right now who's 19, 20 years old, never really done diet, and we're now looking at diet because his mom knows that even a few, you know, she's done like a few day trials here and there and knows that that really helps. So, you know, I think that all the stuff you hear about, oh, if, you know, there's a window and when they're older, blah, blah, blah. But we all know that even if you're 92 years old and you take, if you have celiac and you take gluten out, you are going to feel incredibly better. And the same subject, the same thing applies for anybody who needs a special diet or wants to get more nutrition in. Now, is it easier to recover a child when they're younger and they've had less, you know, years of inflammation? Yeah, sure. But that, I definitely think that a special diet can help anybody at any age and is worth a try.
Very nice. I hope I'm pronouncing this name right. Risa, R-I-S-A. Risa from Ohio, Toledo, Ohio asks, do you know if any of the enzyme supplements are vegan?
I'm thinking. I know most of, I don't know that off the top of my head. I know that most of them are fungal-based, but I don't know what kind of capsules that people always use. I know sometimes they'll do no capsules, so if it's a matter of the gelatin capsule, you could probably just get the powder and, you know, do something that way. So off the top of my head, I don't know the answer. I tend not to have really any vegan clients, so I just, you know, if it's a matter of gelatin or something like that, we could probably search out an answer, but I just don't know off the top of my head.
And probably they list that on the website?
Yes, they would list what their capsule's made out of. Uh-huh.
I've been with Houston back when they were Houston Nutraceuticals.
Yep. Me too.
So it's nice to see that they simplified their name just a little bit.
Yep. That's funny. I still think of them by that name.
I do, too. I do, too. That's what I would Google if I was looking for them.
Yeah.
Just to remind people on the phone, if you want to ask a question, just press star 2, and that raises your hand for me. In the meantime, this may be not too specific. Ian from Calgary asks, it seems that families are having success with the low oxalate diet. What flour do you recommend using if you were doing this diet?
Well, if you're only doing the low oxalate diet and you're not doing like the specific carbohydrate or something on top of it, it's a little bit easier. You can do, usually they'll use a blend of some of the lower oxalate flours like rice flour or maybe a small bit of potato starch, maybe a bit of water chestnut flour, or for people that are on a low oxalate and a grain-free diet, then coconut flour is a good low oxalate choice for that. Also, people will sometimes blend pumpkin seeds and make a flour out of that and use that as a portion of the flour blend.
Mm-hmm.
Those are the ones that come to my mind right now.
Okay. Lorraine from California asks, yogurt made with raw milk, is this allowed on the GFCF diet?
It's not. So the gluten-free and casein-free, the true gluten-free and casein-free diet doesn't allow any milk. Now, raw milk, I think, has some wonderful properties. It's got some live enzymes. It's got some live bacteria. It's got some really good live immune system compounds. From a nutritional perspective, it is superior. From a digestion perspective, it's easier. However, it's still going to have casein. So even if it's fermented, there's still going to be some casein. Now, people do tolerate it better, and people tolerate raw goat's milk yogurt even, you know, probably better than raw cow's milk yogurt. So there is a place for it, and there are some people that, you know, especially as the healing takes place and maybe they're doing the diet for a couple of years, where they can pull in some of those things. Now, for people that, you know, so I would say that, you know, it's all on an individual basis, but the true definition and the true implementation of a gluten-free and casein-free diet, the casein would be no animal milk, whether it's goat, cow, raw, pasteurized, or anything.
Okay. Donna from Holly asks, has your take on camel milk changed as of lately, and can it help with food allergies, camel milk?
Mm-hmm. It hasn't changed, you know, much. I still think it has some wonderful immune system potential. I still think it's something to consider. What I would say is that, I'll tell people that are listening, there was a study. So if you look at my article, you see there was a study that was done for children with food allergies, anaphylactic to practically everything, including milk, and everyone on the study was able to tolerate the camel's milk. However, let me just say I'm not a doctor, and I want to make sure you have full, good medical support before you try something that could have a life-threatening implication. But that is what that one study showed. I think it was 8 children that they followed, and I think it was really more of like a case study that was done by Dr. Yagiel, I believe. So I find it very intriguing and interesting. You know, they found, I think it was no circulating IgE-mediated response or something from the camel's milk. So there's a lot of little interesting things that point to a lot of benefit. But like I said, I'm not here to, I would just feel, that's kind of a serious condition for me to give the green light to. So I'll just kind of leave it at that. And then there's some question about the cerebral folate deficiency and the antibodies to the cerebral folate receptor and all of that. And they're really, it's very new, and I don't want to dismiss it because it has some level of concern, but it also is pretty new as well. So I think that I wouldn't say that it's definitively figured out one way or the other. I mean, we've tried camel's milk in our house. In fact, I'm planning to order some next week, hopefully, or in next couple weeks. So I do believe in it, in that I do use it and other things for my family as well, although we don't have allergies. It's of course very different.
How's the taste compare?
It's sometimes I drink it and I think, wow, this is delicious. And sometimes I drink it and I go, all right, that's a camel kick, and I can't quite put my words to what it is, but there is definitely a camely something. And, it's like sometimes I do have to kind of choke it down. So it really varies day to day, and it probably just depends on what the camel was eating or something,
got into the onion patch.
Yeah, right, exactly.
Several people are expressing confusion over raw milk and whether it's GFCF. Could you touch on that?
Yeah, is there anything else about the raw milk, like any other specific questions, like that other person that would tell me what they're concerned about? They're thinking that it is
basically just asking, is it okay on the GFCF diet? Is raw milk okay?
Got it. So my answer to that is that pasteurized does do problematic things, and there are some people that really tolerate raw much better. There's some people that tolerate raw do not tolerate pasteurized. However, there still is the casein molecule in there. So if you have a more significant casein issue, then you're probably still going to have a problem with it. My experience with most of my clients is that they're so committed to GFCF, they're a little afraid to try it. So I don't have an enormous percentage of my GFCF clients that have tried it. But the ones that I have and the ones that I've heard of that have tried it, it's tolerated by a small percent, but it's not tolerated by a huge percent, especially when, to me, the form of milk is also a factor. So Goat is definitely tolerated better than cow, and camel's tolerated better than all the others. And then the raw is, I think, another level of benefit. But again, it's not considered casein-free.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Can you recommend a commercial non-contaminated oat?
Ah, yeah, there's onlyoats.com. There's glutenfreeoats.com, and there's Bob's Red Mill. Bob's Red Mill has many different kinds of oats, so you will want to make sure that you're getting their one. They have, you know, a rolled and a steel cut that specifically on the label say certified gluten-free. They will all say certified gluten-free on the label.
As a mom and a support group leader and friend, I hear more parents say about the GFCF diet, there's no way I could switch my child to the GFCF diet because all they eat are goldfish and drink milk,
mm-hmm.
and they would starve to death.
Yep.
What do you say to that?
I would say that almost everybody says that same thing to me, too. and I would say that, you know, to me, that's another reason to try the diet, because if they're eating nothing but those foods, it's very likely that that's because they're creating some sort of opiate. And while it might seem really overwhelming, that's another, you know, that's another reason that that diet might be helpful. I would also say that out of my experience, a majority of kids are able to make the switch and actually become less picky once those opiate foods come out. So they'll often eat vegetables and eat a much more well-rounded diet than they did before. They might eat more protein, more different textures, things like that. And that is the pretty common experience among most of my clients. Now, you know, there's always some that can't. There's always some that, definitely look for support from a feeding therapist if you think you can't do it on your own. Maybe consider some digestive enzymes as a start, something like that. Those are probably some of the things that I would say to those parents.
Mm-hmm.
It's a very reasonable question.
Right. My child was one of those.
And what was your experience?
After the hamburger bun incident of 2007, we just started substituting the few foods that he would eat with their GFCF counterpart, and then began to add more and more acceptable foods, and he would eat them. You know, when I thought, he's never going to eat that, he would. And so, you know, he's got a whole repertoire of foods that he will eat now, and even the gluten-free, casein-free version of the foods that he loves.
Mm.
Now, some of them are really hard
right.
to find, like pizza and bread.
Mm-hmm.
But if you find them, hang on to them.
Yeah, absolutely. I appreciate hearing that, because that's also my experience. And like you said, you can take it one step at a time rather than being overwhelmed. And, you know, I'm not necessarily the biggest fan of the cold turkey method just because it is kind of, you know, it's kind of a lot of change all at once. It can
mm-hmm.
be a little tough. So there's a lot of different ways to implement or ease into it or those kinds of things as well.
Right. Along those same lines, Renee from Melbourne, Florida says, it sounds like it takes a lot of time and commitment to understand what to do regarding the GFCF diet and then to apply it. Do you find that most of your parents are stay-at-home parents?
No. I would say certainly I have more stay-at-home parents that have children with autism than don't have autism, certainly. But there are a lot of my parents that work. I hear what you're saying, and it is a bit overwhelming at first, and it definitely has a sharp learning curve. But once you get past the learning curve, it's pretty easy. It's like, you know, it's like Nancy said, it's like you find your bread, you find that they like, let's say, Oodies or something, which is one of my favorites. And
mm-hmm.
then You know, then you figure out the hidden sources is the biggest thing, one of the biggest things, and finding brands that you like is probably one of the biggest things. But we have to remember, meats and vegetables and fruits and eggs and nuts and beans and anything whole like that is naturally gluten and casein free. So it's really only the dairy things and the bread things, the grain things, that really we need to like do a lot of, you know, kind of searching and figuring out. And really, you know, get yourself a good source of hidden ingredients. You know, maybe get a one that's done this before to assist you. And then it really doesn't take, I'm going to be bold here and say it doesn't take any more time to do the gluten-free and casein-free diet than a regular diet. Unless you're baking a bread from scratch, or doing something very special. But, you know, it's really very minimal once you make it over that learning curve.
Okay, and do you find that behaviors increase as you're removing opiates from their diet? There may be an increase in behaviors?
Yeah, you know, with any of these, with any diet, I suppose that's a possibility. And particularly when you're removing opiates, it's like you're literally removing a drug. And you can get kids that aren't so happy about that. And definitely you can get some increased behaviors. But some of them, their tummy just feels so much better that they're actually fine. Some of them.